great. Beauty.
Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of Third Degree Burn. This is your host, Kirk Greenfield, back from a little vacation. Didn't get here for the first episode of the Alpha Flight series, but I'm here for the second, and I'm joined with a number of guests here. Just to my right, we have Tim Elliott.
Hello.
And we have Nigel Sphinx.
Hello there.
And we have John Hyatt with Hello. A special guest.
Hi, Fred West, John's husband.
And so we have five people here. We'll see if Brian is able to join us later. I'm not certain. We are recording this, pulling back the curtain a little bit. We are recording this during halftime of Super Bowl. And for those of us who are passionate football players, we're probably glued to the screen or eating something. Those of us who are passionate comic folks are here with you tonight. So don't tell us how the game turned out, because we're going to be enjoying Alpha Flight numbers 2 and 3. Now, I understand we did an in-depth coverage of the first double-sized episode. I'm sorry, first double-sized issue, which was last episode. And I'm sorry I wasn't here, but I did share a couple of my comments. Who's on deck with issue number 2?
I have issue 2, but I think let's take 5 minutes here real quick, because Kirk, you and John and Fred were not able to attend our recent coverage of the FF, the new FF movie trailer. So quickly, just give us your impressions since we didn't get to hear from you.
I have to confess, I have not seen it. Over to you.
Oh, well, that's easy.
I saw it. I thought it was great. I loved the kind of mid-century modern vibe that I was seeing in the trailer. And I don't know, like, whether that's saying, I heard it was only a small part of the movie, but I loved that we were taking it back to the 50s and 60s, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it.
Is it true they have multiple versions of Reed Richards from the still shot that I saw? That's what I took from it.
I don't think that's, I think that's, somebody put that together. I don't think that's in the film.
Oh, that's a fanfic image?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It's not the Council
of Reeds.
I've not
seen the trailer. Sorry, I shouldn't comment.
We should watch it. It's nice. It's nice and bright and hopeful and looks like a lot of fun, and they're leaning into the family aspect of it. So
I think it's going to be I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it and how they reboot the franchise. The series looked bright and colorful. I like that. And it was kind of quick and not a lot really for us to kind of grab onto, but I'm really kind of hoping to see it turn out to be successful. It'd be great to have a nice Fantastic Four movie back.
Yep. I'm optimistically
and I like the
hopeful.
End where we saw the silhouette of Galactus that was actually Galactus and not space cloud bar from Star Trek.
Exactly.
Cool. Is anybody fired up for the Valentine's Day debut of... Is it Brave New World? Captain America Brave New World?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I think that's what it's called. I'm kind of curious about it. I'm not rushing out to get my ticket right away, but I'm curious as to I'm more curious about the Red Hulk and how that's going to turn out.
Yeah, I have a special interest in it because our local family-owned movie theater, Movies 10 here, has put out an appeal, I'd say within the last month, saying, folks, times are tough. We're seeing lots of theaters close. And they admitted, we're on the edge. Please come out with your family if you want us to continue. And I was really surprised they were so brutally honest. Mm. Brutally honest, because we've already had two other theaters in the general area here in Southeast Ohio, where I live, that have announced they're closing their doors. In fact, one may already be closed. So, I not saying that they're pinning their hopes on the Captain America movie, but I think they're concerned that so many people are watching streaming and people due to the pandemic or finances or what have you just are not turning out to the movie theaters enough to support their family operation that has been going for at least, I'm going to say, 30 years in this area. They built the theater while I was here. Because I remember the coverage of the debate over where it should be located. Anyway, that's just beside the point. Any other Marvel news?
I don't think so.
No Alpha Flight news to share? For a series that's only, what, 30 years old?
That's what we need Brian for. Brian's our resident
historian.
Marvel historian and rumor monger.
I love that.
Well, if there's nothing else, it's on you, Tim.
All right. I'm on deck. So as Kirk said, we are covering issues 2 and 3, and we will continue this like we normally do. I think we do these sequential ones. We do them 2 at a time. And we will also be doing the backup stories that are in each of these first like 12 issues. Mm-hmm. So there's like a 17-page story, then there's like a 5-page little backup origins. So we're going to cover those as well. So, okay, Alpha Flight number 2. It's at a cost of 60 cents.
Wow.
Yep. Our writer is John Byrne. Our penciler is John Byrne. Our anchor is John Byrne. Colorist is Andy Yanchus. Letterer is Tom Orzechowski. Our cover art's by John Byrne and I believe Terry Austin. Our editor was Denny O'Neill, and our editor-in-chief was Jim Shooter. This had a release date of June 14th, 1983, with a cover date of September 1983. Other Byrne books at the time, he was still doing FF. So we had Fantastic Four 258, he was writer-artist. Marvel Team-Up 133, he was the cover inker on that issue. And The Thing, number 3, he was a writer. And this is reprinted in Alpha Flight Classics Volume 1 and the Alpha Flight Omnibus, which I believe somebody is reading from this show today. Alpha Flight number 2, Shadows of the Past. This is the first story of this issue. The members of Alpha Flight gather at an old Canadian military proving ground near the Albany River. Vindicator runs them through a series of combat training exercises in order to hone their skills. Despite a few mishaps and the inevitable brawl between Puck and Sasquatch, the team enjoy their time together, and Mac feels confident that Alpha Flight could one day become a nationally recognized as the Avengers. Shaman, ever acting the part of Vindicator's conscience, reminds him that while he wears the flag of Canada, perhaps he should embody the country's spirit. He compares him to his American counterpart, Captain America. Suddenly, Puck notices that Marina is acting strangely. He approaches her out of concern, but Marina turns feral, slashing out with him with her razor-sharp claws. As Puck falls over and nearly disemboweled, Marina dives into the water and swims away. Northstar and Aurora attempt to follow her, but she's already too far away. Vindicator and Shaman rush to Puck to the hospital. Shaman uses his Sakri? Is that his tribe?
Mm-hmm.
Sakri. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Okay. Sakri magic powder to stabilize his condition, but it is his skills as a surgeon that ultimately saves his life. While Shaman labors to save Puck, Vindicator ruminates over the circumstances that brought Marina to Alpha Flight's fold. Flashback. 18 years ago, fisherman Tom Smallwood fell in from the deck of his trawler during a massive rainstorm. Mired down by his fishing net, he began to sink to the bottom of the sea. However, his attention caught sight of a glowing green egg. He was able to snatch it up and use it to buoy himself to the water surface. Taking the egg home with him, he showed it to his wife, Gladys. The egg hatched, bringing forth an infant aquatic life form. Naming her Marina, the small witch took the child into their home and raised her as one of their own. At age 16, Marina's aquatic superpowers fully developed. Smallwoods found that she could not only survive indefinitely underwater, but could swim at speeds in excess of 800 knots per hour. Within a short time, the administrators at Department H discovered Marina's existence, and James Hudson personally recruited her into the Beta Flight program. Marina excelled as a member of Beta Flight, and within a span of four months, was already become a full-fledged Alpha. The rest of the Alpha Flights gathered together aboard the Quinjet and began tracking Marina's path via the signal device located in her locket. She swims to the North Pole, where she arrives at a frozen glacier facility. Rising up out of the water, Marina finds herself in presence of a costumed man who calls himself the Master. To be continued. Our backup story. Origins of Alpha Flight in the beginning. This has the exact same crew on it. James McDonnell Hudson is a young scientist working for the AmCam Corporation. He has designed a cybernetic suit of armor for purposes of development, excavation, and exploration. However, his project team leader, Jerry Jackson, comes into his office one day and tells Mac that he is taking the project away from him. Jackson is handing the cyber suit over to the American military, one of AmCam's largest defense contractors. Hudson is furious that his work is being used for the American war machine and quits his job. As he storms out of the building, he bumps into Jackson's secretary, Heather McNeil. McNeil tells Mac that she heard about what happened and had tendered her resignation when she discovered how the company had treated him. Although Hudson doesn't know it yet, Heather and he will be married to to one another within less than a year. Later that evening, Max schemes against his former employers. He returns to AmCam and steals a cyber suit. He then breaks it, uses it to break into the company's security vault so that he can destroy all blueprints related to the machine's design. He's happy to discover that the blueprints remain in a sealed envelope, so he knows that nobody could have copied them. Using the apparatus, his gauntlet, he incinerates all of the classified documents. Mac then takes the suit out of the building and parks it on a nearby hill. He recognizes that the armor suit is technically AmCam property, but he designed his cybernetic helmet prior to his work for the corporation. The armor will not be functional without the cybernetic helmet, so Mac takes it with him. The end.
Good summary.
Well, I stole it off, okay, so I did not write that. I won't take credit for something I didn't write. I gotta say that I
really enjoyed this one. I think perhaps it's because it was unexpected that we were going to focus on the unknown characters. We know now, of course, that it's they're Beta Flight characters that have accidentally been called up into Alpha Flight. But I thought it was a brilliant move of strategy to keep our attention rooted on new characters and start to give us some backstory on them. Couple things I wanted to point out. I hope I'm not stealing anybody's thunder here, but this scene about the trawler and being swept overboard comes decades before that movie, The Perfect Storm. But mm-hmm. It has a very interesting vibe along that line. That's one. And two, Ma and Pa Kent raised Superman. And I got a little bit of an echo, a little vibe of that as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody else noticed. Mm-hmm.
No, now you mention it, though, yeah. In a similar way, yeah, and they find the egg and bring her up as their kid.
Yep.
Yeah, very similar. Mm.
There are a lot of seeds I found thrown in here, knowing where the story goes and who develops into what. Not only Heather as the secretary, we know where she's going to develop, but also in terms of Jerry Jackson in the backup story. And a couple of other things, Shaman, and we have a lack of backstory for him right now, as far as I can tell. But a lot of this is foreshadowing. I think Byrne very clearly knew the broad arc where he was going. Mm-hmm. He knew when to sprinkle things in. I don't think things happen by chance. And so I appreciate more and more each time I read one of these stories and look at the, I'm going to say, 28 issue arc, for lack of a better term, and see how much, if he didn't care for this story, he certainly put a lot of effort into it, and it feels rich and like there's quite a tapestry here. One thing I wanted to point out, the flashback, there are several references to the Southeast Asian War and the American war machine. And in another issue or so, we're going to have somebody point out news headlines, Fantastic Four attempt space flight. So it really positions this as being, at least the flashbacks, in the early 60s, as opposed to modern day that we have in the rest of this arc.
Well, I always assumed, that's my same notes, Kirk, that it's the origins of the suit. It says it's 10 years, so I assume it's 10 years prior to the current issue. So if the current issue is supposed to be in 83 when it was published, this would make it 73. So the reference to the Vietnam War would work, but then it doesn't, and that's with the sliding timeline of Marvel, but then it doesn't quite fit in with, as you point in the later episode issue that he mentions the FF. So that would, to me, that would put them as going into space in the 70s, not the 60s.
Yeah, I only say the 60s because I know that's when they first were published. Maybe I should back off on that.
Well, it doesn't matter. It's that sliding time scale. It has to be, when certain things take, because they don't often make reference to actual events or place things in a distinct timeline. So this could be, we don't know if this is supposed to be 83 when the book is published. Maybe it's much earlier. I don't know.
What did you think of his battle suit or battle armor? It's evoking some memories in me, but I can't come up with what it looks like. Is it the Hulkbuster armor from the first Avengers?
It looks a little like, didn't he design some Hulkbuster armor like this when he was doing his issues of the Hulk? I mean, it's Burn Tech, but it looks like.
Not sure. Not sure. Anyway, what do the rest of you guys think?
You know, I really like, I do like this focus on the smaller characters and ones that are really unknown. I like seeing Snowbird's alter ego at the office, you know, kind of thing to show the quote unquote humanity of Snowbird, you know, that she's got a regular job kind of thing. And I always liked Heather because here's somebody that doesn't have any superpowers and she's kind of holding everything together, you know? So I do like this focus on the smaller characters.
I agree.
I thought the only thing I thought was that this feels like a later issue that we're jumping kind of right into Marina's gone bad. You know, she's got this evil side. We don't know about her. It feels like a story that would be maybe a year or two into a run that then they would do something like this. But Byrne jumps right into it. Second issue that there's right. something gone wrong with her and they were going to get her backstory and introduces the master. So I thought it was interesting that.
I was pretty shocked by the slash. I'll call it the slash, particularly as we get to the bottom of. I'm sorry, my pages here in the trade paperback are not numbered, but it's page 50 in the trade. When Puck, got to watch my language here. Puck clutches his chest and kind of bends over, saying, "Choke, help me." There's no red in the version that I'm reading. There is no gore, but there are black shreds of his suit. And you can't quite tell whether that's suit or blood that's dripping. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very cleverly positioned because we don't know exactly where he's been slashed, except that another page or two, Shaman says, "Hey, I've stabilized him as much as I can. We need to get him to a hospital." And that won't pay off until another couple issues.
Well, he says
under the impression it was next issue, but it's not.
No, it's but he did say he was almost nearly disemboweled.
Yeah,
that tells the extent of the damage that.
Yeah, pretty shocking as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you don't just introduce two characters to turn one into a slasher and the other a victim. I mean, wow, talk about throwing gas on the fire.
Yeah.
We also get on, and I think it's minor numbered either, but I think it's page 3. It's after. Marina has doused Sasquatch and Puck's laughing at him. And they're Puck and Sasquatch had kind of a Johnny Storm, Ben Grimm kind of relationship. You know, one's always poking the other one. And then when Shaman is telling, this is where we get the, where he decides to drop the name Vindicator and go with the name Guardian. But Sasquatch is with Northstar and Aurora and he's, Northstar is kind of chiding Sasquatch. And he makes it a derogatory remark, which I thought was pretty bad. He says, "I may have a sudden craving for frog's legs," in reference to Aurora and Northstar being French Canadian. So
I don't quite get that, but obviously they're trading quips back and forth. But I didn't find the expression "frog's legs" to be offensive. Can you amplify?
Well, frogs. Well, that's a derogatory term for the French frogs.
Yeah, okay. The frogs, yeah.
He says frogs' legs.
Okay.
So he's gonna eat him.
You know, there's this whole kind of understory about why the twins predominantly speak French is, you know, the Quebec and wanting to be separated from Canada and have their own French thing. So there's a lot of pride for them around their Frenchness kind of thing. And I don't think a lot of Canadians outside of the Quebec kind of thing understand that, you know, kind of thing. So,
right.
Especially back in the 80s.
I noticed that through this issue, at least, she's entirely in her Aurora personality. There's hardly a mention, I think, of what's her
Jean-Marie.
Jean-Marie.
Yes, Jean-Marie. There's like no explanation for this dominant personality, although we will get there very shortly.
Mm-hmm.
There's no explanation of why she's flamboyant or, so to speak, out there or what the problem is. I like the fact that each one of these characters is flawed. That's one thing that really jumped out at me when I first bought this series. It's like every single one has their cross to bear. and it's all original. It's all different. No matter what their character is, I thought Byrne did a brilliant job of not just, okay, this one's going to be a romantic triangle, and this one is going to be the Hulk in a different color. He did a really good job of fleshing out unique characters.
Well, I think that's a Marvel trait that goes back to when Stan and Kirby did the first FF, where they were a unit, but they weren't perfect. They argued, they bickered, they had
a different views of family.
There were exactly. I think that's an aspect of the Marvel teams that have been in there. These people, it makes them more believable. Exactly. I mean,
I wanted to share a small thing. You know, we always watch for things written in the corners or signposts in the background. On the flashback where Marina is hatched from the egg, about the fourth panel on that page, she's playing with Tim Smallwood, her sort of adopted brother, and they're playing with wooden blocks. Now, I've been trying to make something out of the letters that are there, and I've only had partial success with this, so I won't toot this horn very loudly. But the second layer, first is TR at the top. Ignore that. The middle layer Moab. Is MOAB, Moab, which is a town in Utah. Beyond that, I can't tell you anything more about the religious implications of that, but that's the only thing I could make out of this stack of children's blocks. Did anybody get anything better?
I honestly didn't. I was kind of focusing on the artwork. I didn't try to decipher
Let's just let that one go then.
Yeah, there's not a lot of... there's not a lot of... I've lost what I'm going to say.
There's not a lot of hidden information.
A-E-I-O-U. Yeah, there's not a lot of... Thank you. God, that would not come to me then. Yeah, there's not a lot of vowels to play with there. So I don't think there is much more to it. Okay, as you say, though, you've managed to find out that Moab is actually a place somewhere, which I wouldn't have known. But
Moab's it's not very far from where I'm at right now.
Right.
I've been to Moab.
Tim, share with us where you're at so people understand.
I am in the great city of Las Vegas.
So Moab, being in the southern end of Utah, would be sort of a weekend destination if you like to visit rock formations and desert southwest.
Yeah, it's
long weekend drive.
Where's Moab?
It's on the southeast. It's in the mid-east. It's a good 6 hours from you, Tim.
Okay. So it's not too far away.
Yeah. I only know it because when I lived for a year in Salt Lake City, I intentionally made a drive down to see Arches National Park, which is in that immediate vicinity. So I'm a little oversensitive to it. That's all.
Well, I grew up an hour away from it.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yeah. Well, Kirk, in that same panel, which I think is the we talked about this in our previous episode, we were talking about her, that there didn't seem to be any kind of a reaction to Marina's appearance. The fact that she's green with big eyes, she has webbed hands, but
she's obviously alien.
Well, Byrne's explanation is, and I don't know how the people that from Canada feel, is that is in a closed, frequently inbred community. like that tiny island, which is somewhere off Newfoundland.
Yep.
Freaks and sports are not uncommon. So doesn't say much for the people that live there, but apparently they think she's just what they may see as some kind of defect as being part of her being inbred, possibly. So I don't know anything about the islands off Newfoundland, but
never mind that she was an egg found on the bottom of the ocean floor, but okay.
Except I'm sure they don't. Knows that.
They don't tell
nobody
that, right? That. No, it's like Clark Kent. They don't say that we found her and she became this miniature little thing.
I remember initially reading this as the guy's sinking and he sees the egg. That was one page. He had to turn the page and then he grabs a hold of it. And I was thinking, you know, as I turn the page, oh, don't grab. You know, each time they touched it, I kept thinking, like, here we go. I mean, he had me right there with the story as it was unfolding, but I was already saying, don't.
Well, it's like that commercial, that Jameson commercial, the guy drops his barrel of whiskey over and he jumps in after it.
Yes. Yes. That's good. Anything else people want to share with this one before we move on?
Well, we haven't even talked about meeting the master.
Oh, that's a good point.
Leads right up to this this ending where they're all funny. But first, I want to go back and one of the things that I've always pointed out that I enjoy about Byrne is when Puck was slashed on us going way back, but just the reactions on Alpha Flight's faces was incredible. I mean, yes. He definitely looked shocked. Just, I love the way that he is so good about making that happen.
Yeah.
So, but then Marina's swimming off somewhere and ends up in a icy cavern somewhere.
That's the North Pole.
Does that sound familiar?
What? Logan's Run?
Well, I was thinking more in terms of Superman, the movie, The Fortress of Solitude, or going further back, Submariner 99, no, Tales to Astonish 99, where, I'm not saying this right, Iron Man Submariner issue number one that leads into the Silver Age solo series of the Submariner, he is drawn to an Arctic cave where he meets the villain Destiny, who reveals the secret behind his amnesia. And I was getting some vibes about that. It was like, oh, is he playing on this?
Mm-hmm. Kirk, I have a question on, since you're a resident weatherman.
Yeah.
It says that Marina can swim up to 800 knots. How fast is a knot?
That's a good question. I don't know. If you want me to try to look it up on my computer while we move on, I'll try to check it out for
that
you,
just
but
seems,
I really don't know.
That just seems awfully fast for underwater.
Yes, it is. I think that's the point. He's trying to point that she can get away from them in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
She's not all that they thought she was.
Or that the Albany River was that deep that there was enough water for her to come back past it. I found a little kind of like... that river doesn't look that deep next to the training ground. And yet she jumped in, dove under, and there was enough volume for her to completely submerge and then take off without any of them seeing, without a wake being cast up behind
her. That
was
my question. I think that would cause a lot of damage, Fred, if she's going that fast underwater.
Yeah.
But
well, it did show a knot's just a little over a mile per hour or just under.
Oh, okay. So she's going 800 miles an hour. That's still fast.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty fast. So, but it did show her. Oh no, it was when the twins left. That's when it created the separation, the parting of the sea, so to speak.
Yeah, they did a. She pulled a Heston on that one, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely.
But she certainly outswam the man from Atlantis, and you know, any of our other famous swimmers that could swim fast. So.
Yeah, I don't think Patrick Duffy could outswim all that fast, especially that kind of floppy kind of thing he came up with, the way he would swim.
Yeah.
Was it 800 knots or 900?
800.
Well, according to my AI, which I hate on my phone, it says it's equivalent to approximately 921 miles per hour, or that'd be 1482 kilometers per hour for those of us who are not on the metric system, or rather who are on the metric system.
That just seems still a little fast. I mean, it'd be like she might be able to swim that fast, but would she? I just think it would just cause a huge wake or a huge, cause something, some kind of problems.
Hey, it's comics.
It is. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything on the backup? Where we didn't really talk about the backup story where we meet Mac for the first role. When we meet the company he was working for, AmCam, and he's developed this big exoskeleton, I guess, for exploration or something.
Oil exploration.
Right.
That's what they were talking about. He seems thinner. He seems more angular. He seems younger, but I can't point to anything really definitively that makes me think that, except for the opening splash panel when he's in a white suit lab coat.
Yeah.
He gets a Reed Richards beard too.
One of the things that kind of jumped out at me, it didn't jump out at me in the 80s when I read this, but when I, you know, having however many years between the 80s and now, I don't like to talk about that number, but I'm like, he would be diagnosed with anger management issues. Like he would have to go to some anger management because, you know, he's, and I get he's getting laid off, his project's taken away, but the man snaps at the drop of a hat and, you know, some of his decision making processes, I would have to question seriously. You know, it just seems a little snappy, a little ragey, a little like, are we sure this is the best decision? And again, I think that's why Heather is so important, that he has, you know, the stabilizing influence, even though she's what, 17 at this point.
Yeah, she's pretty young.
Yeah. So. Well, and her quitting is a little simplistic. I mean, for storytelling wise, she's like, well, I'm quitting out of solidarity. You know, I can't stand what they did to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so. They did it in what was that? Jerry McMurphy. What was that?
Jerry Maguire.
Yeah. Somebody quit on impulse with him. I think in the 60s, it was a different time, that if you wanted a child bride, so to speak, there wasn't as much criticism of it. You know, it was somewhat accepted that young women were going to leave the workforce, and that it was acceptable for them to want to become young mothers.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say another thing about quitting on impulse. What about John Byrne quitting Captain America? Because of what happened to Roger Stern.
Yeah, anger issues.
Well, what they don't ever talk about is that, yes, he's quitting and he thinks he's quitting on his moral feelings of, I'm not going to, and he says, I don't want my work be so used by the U.S. military to destroy Southeast Asia or something, which is a reference to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So he steals a suit. He cuts through apparently 10 floors of a building, rips this vault out and burns up the plans, and then takes off. So he does a lot of property damage, which hopefully the building is vacant. But he's not thinking of, maybe somebody might lose their job over this or anything. So he's kind of taking the moral high ground. And then then he's like, I'm just going to leave the suit here because I don't technically own it, but I'm going to take my helmet. So that kind of establishes his character. At the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think it also is nice that, to your point, Kirk, that none of these people are perfect. He is struggling. He never wanted to be the leader of Alpha Flight. He always intended that to be Logan. Now it's kind of thrust upon him. So somebody has to do it. So he's kind of struggling with, I don't want to be a hero. You know, I'm not really a hero. I'm a scientist. So.
Yeah. Well, in his first appearances, he certainly was a, what's the word I want? Macho man, aggressive, militarist. Yeah. Militaristic, but that's coming in terms of the flashback stories. That is yet to come.
Right. He's written, I think, differently than when he first wrote him as kind of a
villain.
You're coming with me no matter what, kind of, you know, when he was talking to Logan. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to move on to issue and three.
I just wanted to mention one more thing about when we first read this, or when I first read this anyway, I didn't know about how they got Byrne to do Alpha Flight. Yeah, I just assumed, you know, they were his creations, and so he was willing to do this from the beginning, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Yes. And then only afterwards, when finding out that they kind of, they didn't force him to do it, but, you know, he didn't want to do it, but he decided he'd better do it if he wanted it to go, you know, for his characters to be done in the right way, if you like. But as a result, he was kind of making sure that we as the readers were not going to get what we perhaps thought we were going to get. And
that's true.
One thing that comes that I noticed at the beginning, near the beginning of the story, when... after Sasquatch has just sort of got together with Aurora and North Star, and they're kind of sort of talking to one another, and Sasquatch has said about the frog's legs. Mm-hmm. And then Aurora says, no, no, mon cher Walter, enough of this bickering. We're not the Avengers, ne sais pas. Well, at the time, if you were reading the Avengers, you would know that, the Avengers, from time to time, they kind of get at one another, don't they? They're like Cap's always fighting with Iron Man and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as you probably thought about it at the time. But that's a good kind of point to say that these guys are living in the same universe as the Avengers.
Yes.
And that's it for that. But then now, knowing about what Byrne was doing with the Alpha Flight, and as I say, I've got this thing about he always planned to do it differently. And a lot of readers, like myself included, thought that, yeah, this was going to be like the Canadian Avengers. And so in a way there, where she's saying, you know, we are not the Avengers, he's also kind of giving them a subtle message. So, you know, don't expect these this group to be like the Avengers as this goes along, because it's not going to be like that.
Yeah.
I've got other plans for these characters and you might not like it. And then, of course, he's straight into Marina slashing Puck. And away we go. Like, I mean, at the time, I thought, oh, yeah, this is good. This has got me intrigued, you know, where what's happened to Marina?
Yeah.
But, yeah, as Kirk says, I'm sure Byrne had all this sort of thing planned out. And it's good. But, yeah, he knew that perhaps there'd be some of us that wouldn't particularly like where some of this is going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the moment, just by the end of issue two, where we've got the reveal of the Master, it's all just going very, it's quite exciting. You know, it's like, we can't wait for the next part to see what's happening next. Yeah.
I think it had intended to push barriers in some areas, as we'll see in the next several issues. And I think he did it successfully without, I don't want to say crossing the line, but without being overly offensive. Of course, there are some people who will be offended by anything, but let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. And yeah, and then the only other thing I noticed, but we've mentioned it sort of before, is that with Heather and Mac again and the age difference, it's Reed and Sue all over again, isn't it?
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Byrne was a big fan of Lee Kirby, Fantastic Four, as we know. So he's just kind of repeating that here again with Mac and Heather.
Well, I think they wanted for her to quit that way. They wanted to have someone who was young and perhaps impressionable and kind of,
yeah,
you know, she's a little swooned by Mac. Maybe she has a crush on him already, which I think she does.
Yes.
And
those colored glasses.
Yeah. So well, that's why.
Yeah.
And he's like, not tonight, honey. I got something to do. Yeah, I'm going to break in.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think it's pretty clear right from the start that she's into it.
Well, it makes her, she's not timid. She's pretty forward. It's like, hey,
yes.
You know, I like you. Let's have dinner or I'll make you some lasagna or whatever. And that makes her a little bit of a stronger character. She's not the damsel in distress. She's a strong woman in her own right. And she kind of, you know, wants to help him out. So, All right, Nigel, I think you're on deck.
What's that? Okay. So we're looking at Alpha Flight issue number 3, cover dated October, with a price of 60 cents or 25 pence in United Kingdom. Or 75 cents in Canada.
Hmm.
Why do Canada pay more than America for the comics?
Tariffs.
Yeah, Trump tariffs. Okay, before I go into this comic, though, other publications by Byrne that came out at the same time. We've got Fantastic Four number 259 called... The title was Choices, and Byrne was the writer-artist, of course, on that. The Thing, number 4, titled I'm Monster. He was the writer. Yeah. And I've also got here Ohotmu, number 10, Shi'ar to the Submariner. Byrne obviously had one or two character drawings in that particular issue. Okay, looking at this one then. The team on this one, yeah, John Byrne's story and art. Tom Orzechowski, letterer. Andy Yanchus, the colorist. Denny O'Neill was the editor. And it says here, Jim Shooter, Tomorrow Man. And the title of this particular episode is called Yesterday Man. Just a quick mention of the cover. This is one of the like great covers that everybody is impressed by. And it is. I mean, it's a really eye-catching cover. You definitely want to pick this up. And yet, it's so fantastic in its simplicity because apart from Aurora's face, it's all just black and white. But yet, it works. It stands out fabulously.
Well, the grid, I think, is what's impressive about it is this was done by hand. Today, this would be done with the aid of a computer. But he laid all this out with his own perspective lines.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a great cover, yeah. And the shock on her face as well is...
Brilliant.
Well, yeah, well drawn. Okay, so, as I say, Yesterday Man is the title. And here's the synopsis, which I am also borrowing from the Marvel Wiki. So here we go. Snowbird, having received a mystic communique from Shaman, flies across the Northern Territories in search of her friends in Alpha Flight. She finds the crashed remains of the Omnijet and uses her post-cognitive perception powers to replay the events that led to the ship's landing. In the vision, she sees a red laser beam originating from beyond the plains, striking the ship and sending it down into the snow. Her friends survived the crash and left the ship, briskly walking northward. Snowbird begins following Sasquatch's footprints towards their destination in the form of a polar bear. Meanwhile, the rest of Alpha Flight has found an entranceway into the technologically advanced lair of the Master in the hopes of expediting their search for the missing Alphan Marina. They split up into two teams. Vindicator and Sasquatch head off in one direction while North Star and Aurora fly down an alternate tunnel. The teams get cut off from one another and Aurora begins to grow scared. North Star and she lock hands, which generates a blinding glow of light, which illuminates the entire tunnel. As they explore further, large metal poles protrude from the walls. One of them strikes North Star, rendering him unconscious. Aurora grows even more scared and slips into her meek Jean Marie personality. Vindicator and Sasquatch eventually manage to smash through several yards of thick wall in order to find them. Meanwhile, the self-proclaimed master of the world has captured Marina and strapped her to a large torture device. He alludes to the fact that Marina's heritage is alien in origin and that both of their destinies are intertwined with one another. While Marina screams in torment, the master amuses himself by relating his own origin. And in flashback, we get the master once a member of the tribe of humans known as the Eshu that thrived in the northern wastelands over 40,000 years ago. The Eshu maintained a strict code against the taking of human life and discovered that the master had in fact violated this stringent law. Exiled from the community, he wandered south until he felt an instinctive need to change course and head farther north. An unidentifiable summons drew him closer and closer to the North Pole until he discovered the ruins of an enormous spaceship. Entering the vessel, the master found himself at the whims of this seemingly living ship. The ship captured him and used his body for excessive experimentation. It slowly stripped away all of his biological matter for study and then progressively replaced it with renewed tissue. Ugh. The sheer pain and torture of the experience ultimately drew him insane, and he remained a prisoner of the ship's controls for years. Eventually, he regained his sanity and his consciousness evolved to the point that he was able to wrest control of the ship and free himself. The Master concludes his story and tells Marina that the egg that birthed her originated with this ship, and that she belongs to a race of extraterrestrials that came to Earth millennia ago. Before he begins his ultimate takeover of the world, the Master is determined to eliminate all traces of the original alien race. Suddenly, the Submariner and the Invisible Girl appear in the doorway of the Master's torture chamber. Neither hero is prepared to allow the Master to continue with his mad plans. To be continued.
Dum, dum, dum.
Yeah. And so that leaves us, yeah, on a knife edge there. And also see Fantastic Four 260 to find out how Namor and the Invisible Girl got there at the end, on the last page there.
Or is it really them?
Well, who knows? We'll have to wait and see to the next issue. Right. The backstory, carrying on from the last issue. The origin, if you like, of Vindicator / Guardian, created by the same team. And this is called Purpose. Following on from last issue, James MacDonald Hudson sits in his apartment in Edmonton. He ruminates over the events that led him to break into the AMCAM building and steal the cybernetic supersuit. Former AMCAM secretary Heather McNeil stops by the house armed with a fresh supply of groceries. She sees the helmet to the cybersuit sitting on the coffee table and realizes that Mac is the one who broke into AMCAM the previous evening. Heather spontaneously declares her love for Mac, but Hudson is reluctant to reciprocate as she is only 17 years old. Over the following year, however, the two do in fact marry one another. James and Heather travel to the Parliament building in Ottawa and consult with an official named Frank Hulme. James tells him everything that he had done at the AMCAM Corporation and further reveals that he legally owns the helmet that powers the cybersuit. Hulme consults with the Prime Minister, and they realise that Hudson is just the sort of man they need in the Ministry of Defence. Hulme arranges to retroactively place Hudson on the government payroll and makes restitution with AMCAM. Parliament creates a research and development programme under the umbrella of the Ministry of Defence called Department H. And they select Hudson to act as the department's administrator. During this time, he meets the Canadian secret agent known as Wolverine. One day, Hudson reads a newspaper article about a new American superhero team known as the Fantastic Four. Inspired by the article, he decides to create his own Canadian defensive response team called Alpha Flight.
Good job.
And he becomes the reluctant leader of Alpha Flight.
I don't know about how reluctant. I mean, he's in this final pinup. He's
looks quite happy, doesn't he?
Grinning.
Yeah.
He looks very happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at this point, I think he is happy, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But as we've said, he keeps mentioning now and again about he doesn't feel like he was born to be a leader type. Yeah, he finds it a bit difficult.
Are you finished?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I want to point out just a sidelight. In the flashback, in particular, he's always in a red flannel shirt, a red plaid shirt.
Mm-hmm.
That's identical to the one I remember my late father being in when I was a young man, a toddler. He always wore red flannel shirts. Where they came from, I'm not 100% sure. It might have been the Smoky Mountains on their honeymoon, but I remember my father in a red flannel plaid shirt.
He's George Lucas. He's always going to wear flannel. Well, in the flashback, I want to ask, who else had a spool table growing up?
Oh, I did.
Okay.
I don't know
oh,
if
you
that's
mean us.
Yeah, no, yeah. Not... I don't know if that's common in the UK, but here in the States, if you were a college kid.
No, I don't think it's very common in I've never seen anybody with a spool table.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's short. It's a coffee table as it's here. But I can tell you that it was not uncommon for kids to play on large spools that telephone cable came off from. If you could lay your hands on one, hey, it was great. You'd act like you were in the circus and walk like a trained bear or a seal or what have you.
Yeah.
They're hard to come by now, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in that first panel in that flashback, the where it says purpose, bottom left corner of the first panel, Heinz 59. You know what that? Anybody recognize what that's from?
That brown sauce?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a brand of ketchup.
But they also make, don't they make brown sauce, Nigel? You know what that is?
That's HP.
Wrong?
Yeah.
That's okay. HP. That's okay.
Yeah.
And we know that Heather shops at Safeway because that's what's on our bag of groceries.
Yeah.
You're right. I never noticed that.
But I haven't seen Tim Hortons yet. Like, where are the donuts and all, you know?
I think that comes much later.
I don't know. I don't. Tim Hortons is around from the 70s. Is that right? Or is it older than that?
Don't know.
Where are our Canadian commentators? Let us know, folks.
Yeah.
And is the Ottawa Parliamentarian, is that a real newspaper?
Oh. Good question.
Never heard of it.
Well, this flashback at the end, you also get that he is, everything is kind of resolved from the previous issue. They say that, you know, they offer him a job. They want him to start this super team. They're going to straighten out everything with AmCam, so there won't be any, prosecution or anything or any kind of legal damages or anything from him breaking in. So clear all that up. And so then he can start.
And clearly it all happens before the Fantastic Four make their big announcement too.
Right.
You know, all of this is happening prior to the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it appears to be, yeah.
So again, that sliding timeline has to be slid a little differently.
A little further. Yeah.
Well, because they have to have time to set up Department H. They have to find Logan at some point, you know, return him to his humanity and all that, and then start the team. So all this is kind of happening in the background. While the FF are forming, the Avengers, Spider-Man, all that kind of stuff is going on.
So do we think Jim Shooter's title of Tomorrow Man is definitely in reference to the title of this issue, Yesterday?
Oh, yes.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else behind that.
Unless sinister.
Explain something.
No, I have nothing to explain. I'm just... I've never honestly paid attention to these credits until... hearing John on the podcast and looking at this, and you know, there's been a couple that have been like approved by Jim Shooter. It's like, oh, it just smarminess. It just smacked of smarminess to me. It's like, oh, what a jerk kind of guy.
Well, I can tell you the one time that I met Shooter at a Mid-Ohio con. I'm pretty sure it was that or a Columbus con. After he had separated from Marvel, and I believe he was heading up another competing company, he was, I didn't feel overbearing. I found him to be a polite, erudite, young man who was charting a new course with a new company. But I was just an adult fan who met him in the aisles between the vendors and, introduced myself and told him how much I enjoyed the company when he was at the head, no big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met him last year at MegaCon in Orlando, and I met him earlier at a con with Brian, where he was, it was him and Mike Zeck, and because they were kind of doing a Secret Wars kind of little panel, and he got up and talked. And he seemed perfectly, now, Kirk, we'd never worked for him, so that may be totally different, but in person, he seemed perfectly nice.
Yeah. He also knew he was in public and he was talking to the fans. Yeah. He knew that.
Yeah.
I give him a lot of credit for knowing his place, not being a hothead. Mm. But who knows? You know, who knows? So
yeah.
I wanted to, if we're ready to start looking at the issue, I wanted to comment on the cover. For those of us who are long in the tooth here, there's a callback on this cover to Fantastic Four number 17. Now, that would have been about 1964, I'm thinking, maybe 63. Mm-hmm. And it's the issue where there are four separate dooms await the Fantastic Four on the cover. The cover is divided into quarters, and you see each of the Fantastic Four being either checkmated or imprisoned in a different way. Mm-hmm. Sue Storm is in this type of a prison.
Mm-hmm.
It's been pointed out before, but I immediately twigged on that as soon as I saw this cover. It's like the menace of the moving bars. Yeah. Man, that's it. And I love Byrne's use of negative space here in terms of Aurora's costume and the accents of white and her face versus the white bars. The only thing that is a little out of place is the black hair. But I know you guys commented on that last episode, although I haven't finished listening to it, so I won't say anything more. I really like this cover. It really screamed, pick me up, buy me.
Well, it's very similar to a Spider-Man cover he did during the Secret Wars run, where Secret Wars 2, I think, where Spidey's in his black costume, and it's an all black and white. He's swinging over a black and white of the cityscape.
Yes, I remember that one. Boy, we should share some of these images on our Facebook page so people know what we're referencing. I'll try to, I can call up the FF one. I don't know the issue number for the one you're talking about, but we can do that later.
It's the 260s, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I found the art exceptionally good in this one, honestly. You know, not only the cover, I mean, the cover really stands out when you put all the covers on the issues on the table. This one really jumps out at you. But even when you get farther in, you know, when the twins touch their hands, or, you know, it's simple. There's not a lot of color. There's not a lot of oomph and grab, and it's very simple, but it's really detailed. It's a lot of coolness in that, honestly.
I like the first five pages of this issue with the snowbird and her using her powers to look back.
Have we ever heard of this before? Post-cognitive powers? Or is this the first instance?
This is first time she's showing it. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of he's developing out the powers. Remember, we've only seen her a few times before, and it was just as a shape changer. So
yeah.
Mostly. He's really putting some layers and depth into the character here as progressing along, I think. These first few pages with Snowbird are really great. This sequence really made me like Snowbird a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, the last time I said I really liked Aurora, but when these came out, I mean, this really made me a big fan of Snowbird, and looking into the intrigue of what's her background and who she is, and just how different she looked, how she didn't look human when she was in her snowbird form. So that was really cool.
I've got a question. I've been looking this over. In your synopsis, Nigel, it says that the Omnijet was taken down by a red beam. I don't see any image that displays that, and I don't see any dialogue that talks about that. Am I just missing something?
You don't. On page 4 or 5. The top half of the page is like one panel.
Yeah. Sorry,
the top half of the pages makes one panel, one picture. And it's like you can see a series of the jets going back from off the floor. Yeah.
Do you not see that beam that's
Can you not see the red beam going red? across diagonally across the panel?
I'm wondering if I am missing some. Well, I'm looking at a scan. I wonder if I'm missing a page. Oh, I am. They put the page.
Can you see the occupants of the jet at the bottom right escaping?
Yeah. Somehow on my scan, these pages have been put at the end. So somebody screwed up my order of my PDF.
You found them.
I found it, yeah.
Because
I was also missing the page where the master comes up onto the ship and the tendrils come out and grab him.
Yeah. Really?
I've got two pages that are out of order.
Wow.
Oh, dear.
Fire the person.
With the ship. When he first discovers the ship, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't look like he went in voluntarily.
No. Speaking of which, screaming all the way.
I don't think he went in by himself.
People recognize what that image is from? there's a very definite vibe from the movie The Thing from Another World. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, the tendrils coming
out. Yeah, similar to that. Mm-hmm. And that movie was only, would have been a year old when this came out, because they came out in 82. And I got a, I'm not up on all of my DC guys. There's a DC villain who was also a caveman that's lived.
Vandal Savage.
Vandal Savage. Okay.
Yeah.
I know nothing else about him.
Well, I know he was one of the, somebody that's lived like 50,000 years and just and slowly become intelligent.
So I have a question about the twins. So the room's getting darker and they touch hands, but they don't touch their hands. They're both wearing gloves. So it's like, is the ability not, do they not need to touch skin to skin to have the ability to trigger? It seems odd that they're able to trigger it through the gloves of the uniform. Or is that just me?
It's just you. It's comics.
Yeah, but if it's, here's the thing. If it's not, if it's involuntary, if any time they touch, that's going to happen, then surely they've touched or just brushed each other. They're in their street clothes. So I wonder if they have to turn it on when they do it.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I think we're going to discover in a couple of issues when they tell their story that a question is going to get answered.
Yeah, and things change later. Yeah. But that's a, we're talking about the front cover, that middle panel when they first touch it lights up the inside of the screen. That's a a great perspective shot too.
Yeah.
You know what this reminds me of? Now I may be wrong, but you know what it calls to mind? The fight in the blue area of the moon with Phoenix and Cyclops against unsurmountable odds against
Imperial Guard.
Yes, the Imperial Guard on the moon.
Yeah.
This architecture and that perspective, it just calls that to mind to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me of the Krell base from Forbidden Planet.
Yes, good.
Good callback.
The page opposite of that, which has got Guardian in the bottom, he's blasting it, and Sasquatch is tearing apart the walls. That, for me, I don't know if it's because my scan is not a great scan, but that panel looks a little rushed. It's a little less defined, and there are a couple other ones that are like that. And I wonder if, I know when Byrne would draw and ink himself, sometimes he would do rough pencils and then ink, do the finishing ink himself. So he's not penciling the whole thing and then inking it. He's kind of roughing it out and then penciling it or inking it. I wonder if that's a result of that. It just doesn't seem to have his standard, really crisp detail. And it may be the scan I've got. Maybe I'm sure if the trade paperback may look a little more pristine. I don't know.
But. Well, the piece of Sasquatch is lifting over his head look very detailed. It's only the stuff that's kind of on the other side of Sasquatch, which would kind of put it in shadow in a certain way. So I don't necessarily know that you would have to put all that detail into the backside of what's in shadow. You know what I'm saying?
Well, we've talked about this before. When he inks himself, he's a little heavy-handed, and his inking looks a little heavier and darker than, if, say, when Austin's inking him. So that may have something to do with it. When I say not detailed, I mean it looks, the line works a little thicker. And because when Austin does him, everything is really crisp, and the line work is really tight. And I just, this just look a little less than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It still looks good, but.
Yeah.
It's not as good as some of the rest of them. Then he repeats this geometric cage thing, and it's a much smaller panel too.
Oh yeah,
that lower left panel when they first kind of come out, and even when Sasquatch comes out and starts tearing through him.
Yeah, I like that where Northstar is kind of waking up, and then he hears the Aurora's scream, and it's kind of like. He hears the scream, and the scream's in the panel, but he's not actually in that panel. You know, it's kind of a interesting look for how they there.
It's like a window in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the
That's almost anime-like, where
his shoulder background would be moving. The line of the panels kind of thing, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's like anime.
I'm kind of reading this for the first time as we go along. The page before that, when Guardian is comforting Aurora, and she's going, what am I doing here? I was back at the school. the bottom left corner of that page, he says out loud, "Oh no, I was afraid something like this might happen." She slipped back into her Jean-Marie persona. Well, he has to say it out loud because Sasquatch in the next panel reacts saying, "Hey, you haven't told us something or everything, have you?"
Yeah.
I'm thinking that that's more likely something he would think in his head.
Well, it's your point. He has to say it out loud. Right.
Yeah.
And then this is also where Sasquatch calls her a French pastry.
So I think
it's like the term where we said frog's legs in the previous issue. Mm-hmm. I think they're trying to establish Sasquatch's kind of personality there, that he is not being derogatory, but he's more colorful.
Well, he's interested in her. He's attracted to her.
Yeah.
We don't know that yet, but that's where this is going.
Mm.
It's foreshadowing.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a great shot of Marina over that, being held over that pit. Like, and the shot, we look at it, we don't understand what we're seeing. We just assume she's strapped down to a table.
Yes.
But then you go on and you realize she's strapped over a pit. And we're looking, in that shot, we're looking down that pit at it. That's just really great segue, a way to move that along. Just fantastic.
When I was reading this originally, and as you say, the next page, we see that she's over a pit with all these knives and scalpels that are closing in on her. She turns and says, "I've not done anything to you, please. I've never harmed anyone." Mm-hmm. I immediately was thinking, like, really? Really?
Well, she says, "Not until you reached out and touched my mind." Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, like, yeah, she's going to be this victim, this poor, oh dear, this hostage. And I was fully expecting, maybe not this issue, but next issue, she was going to lash out and say, "You have no idea what you've uncorked here. It's Dark Marina."
Dark.
Yeah. Well, I realized that Marina has the same story as the Iron Giant, which we later find out as to why she's on Earth.
Oh, I don't know that.
You've never seen the movie The Iron Giant?
Nope. Sorry.
No.
You can fill me in later.
Missing out. It's a good film.
Okay.
And I went the first page where the master, we don't know his real name, you see him in the past and his tribe are shunning him, so he has to go off. And he says he's drawn somehow. Something is drawing him to the North Pole. And he says he sees others. He said others had also been called, spotting rotting corpses feed him. So it looks like it's a deer or some kind of an animal. So is this ship just sending out for any life form to bring it to it?
Yes. Maybe. We don't know that yet, but yes.
Yeah.
I love this ship when he comes over the rise and it's this large circular thing. Just gorgeous. He does beautiful spreads like this. I love it. And I think, if I read on the side of this, the initials, is this KF or MF? K4F7?
On the ship?
On the right hand.
Oh, I see.
Just missing the C.
I was looking on the left, the little symbol that's on the left side.
Yeah.
Mm. Brian would know if they have any significance.
That's right. Because he would know.
He researched
paging Brian Hughes. Paging Brian Hughes. Report.
Well, the panel that I missed, which was out of order, that upper panel where the Omnijet is being struck and it slowly crashes. Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful page because he's got this little time lapse of the ship, coming down, and it's all done in kind of like greens and yellows to show that it's it's her.
Yeah. It's just a vision. Yeah, it's just a vision kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I love. I mean, I love that I loved her ability for that because we'd never seen that before. Mm-hmm. We've seen precognitive, but never postcognitive, which I just think is cool. Mm-hmm.
Well, she's so tied to the land that somehow, I guess, this has to do with that she can.
Don't get me started on that. We'll get there.
She can call upon the land. It's almost like the land is being a witness and telling her what happened.
Yeah.
I was struck by, again, the villain refers to himself as the master. And then ultimately he says master of the world. You know, I'm not a big Doctor Who fan, particularly at this time, but I had heard that Doctor Who's opponent is the Master.
The Master, yeah.
And I kept one of them. Thinking about that and going, where is he going with this?
Well, so, he looks a little bit like Robert Delgado, who played the original Master in the Pertwee Run, with a little white in his beard. So that's got to be a reference to that.
I think Byrne was a big Doctor Who fan. He was of the right age, the right place for it.
Well, growing up in Canada, they probably, because Canada has, is it CBC?
Yes.
So he probably, he's probably saw Doctor Who. He probably had more opportunity to see it than we do in the States. We had to watch it on Channel 13 or PBS. So I'm sure he got a better chance of watching it. He probably grew up with it.
Well, you also have to be aware that Doctor Who was not originally on PBS when it appeared here. It, they tried to spin it on independent television stations, but we won't get into that. Because it doesn't really matter to this story, but
topic for another show.
Yep. Maybe a comics and coffee.
Yep. Well, I'm going to put this to the group and we can ask the rest of the guys. Should we cover, when we cover our next issue, should we cover FF 260 to tie in with this story?
I don't recall how much is in there. Is it really necessary?
It's not a lot. It's more or less. No, I would say no. I don't think it's worth it.
We can give a brief synopsis of it.
The pages that are relevant.
It's why don't we do just the pages? Just the pages that are necessary.
It's just the back page, or maybe the second, the two at the back. That's all. It's just the appearance of Namor. Although, hang on, though. No. Now, as I recall, but maybe at the beginning of that issue, which is nothing to do with what the FF are actually doing at the time, there's about three pages or so of Namor finding some kind of problem in the waters.
Does he show up at the Baxter building all hurt or something's wrong with him?
It's not very well, because there's something in the water that's kind of poisoned
starts dissolving his bracelets, and then he winds up at her door, I think. So cover it.
I think there is. Yeah, I think there are some other pages with Namor earlier on in that same issue that don't relate to what the FF are actually doing, because they're fighting Tyros at the time, because Doctor Doom has brought Tyros back as Terax again. That's where the FF are at that time. And the Silver Surfer is guest appearing as well.
We should cover those issues, as whoever does this next episode chooses to weave them in. If they feel it's appropriate, let's let them run with it.
I'll have a look at it.
Synopsize it.
Is there anything else we need to cover about this issue? We're in about an hour and a half.
I don't think so. I think we've got everything. One thing that we didn't do that we normally had done in the past is cover other Byrne books during the same month. So the month that this came out, which was...
We did, didn't we?
We did.
I did it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so did Tim, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was great. Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that jumped out at you, John, that you wanted to mention?
Nope.
Okay. I thought maybe there was one that you were.
She just missed it. You know, he wasn't doing eight books like he had in the past. So
right.
No.
Well, I'll confess in closing comments here, I wasn't terribly impressed with the Master either in this appearance or in his future appearances. He didn't really work for me. But in terms of an explanation with Marina and so on, I accept it. And, you know, I won't say that he was lame, but he wasn't as strong a character as I had anticipated.
I feel that way, too.
I don't think he comes back that often, does he? He doesn't come back and he's not
at
like
least
a...
once.
But he's not
it's
a
not
stable...
like every other issue. It's not like he's the Green Goblin.
He's not the Doctor Doom to Alpha Flight, is what I'm saying. He doesn't come back.
No.
Well, I guess if we're... any other closing comments before I say goodnight?
Kirk, why don't you tell the folks where they can get a hold of us or reach us if they would like to?
I will try. The most obvious place these days is the Facebook page, I think, Third Degree Burn, where you'll see all of our shows and episodes promoted. Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Brian, for your excellent job of promoting them. That's probably the fastest way to get a response. If you have any comments or questions or want to share some artwork, that's probably the easiest and fastest way. That's one. Two, you can send email to gottagetburned@gmail.com. Gottagetburned@gmail.com. You can leave us a 5-star review or a 4-star review if you'd like on formerly iTunes now. I can't recall. Somebody
now it's Apple Pod. Now it's Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts. Okay. That's another way to give feedback. Have I missed anything?
Nope. Facebook page is probably the most easy way to get, that's where we do most of interacting with people that listen. We post our shows there, post teasers, we post any kind of news. So that's the easiest interface to try to get anything to us. We don't get a lot of email, but you can email us if you like to.
If you have comments about this series or other series that we've done, we'd love to get some feedback. If you think we're absolutely off the mark and have missed something, we want to hear from you. If there's an opposing view to how what we're presenting, we want to hear it. We want to share it because this is a discussion that we're all participating in. We're not presenting ourselves as experts, although some of us are more skilled and studied in some areas than others, but we want to hear from you. So please join in. Anything else anybody wants to add?
I'd like to hear from some of our Canadian listeners as we cover Alpha Flight.
I concur. I want to hear the Canadian viewpoint as well.
Yeah.
Yep. Were you aware this was coming out? Did you feel this was a cash grab on the part of the suits at Marvel or Curtis or whatever their name was at this point? Or was this just a great major Maple Leaf flag waving experience for you? Multiple choice or make your own.
Right. And how do you feel about Burns' portrayal of Canadians, not just the superheroes, but just the country and the people itself? So I'm kind of curious about that.
Cool.
Okay. Well, I want to thank, go ahead, Fred.
No, I just thank you for letting me come in here and share. This is fantastic.
You are always, always welcome. It doesn't have to be Alpha Flight. It can be whatever you want to come in and talk about. Cool. I would like to thank our guests tonight, especially. It's always fun to get together, especially Fred, who's our newest member. And I'd like to thank the listeners. If you've listened this long, appreciate it. So for Third Degree Burn, I am Tim Elliott.
I'm Kirk Greenfield.
I'm Nigel Spink.
Fred West.
Appreciate it. We'll see you next night.
Yeah. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Good day.
Good day.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.